The writer George Plimpton was many things: highbrow editor, participatory journalist, fireworks enthusiast, New York man about town. Plimpton died in 2003, and he's the subject of a new oral biography edited by his friend, the writer Nelson Aldrich. The book is called George Being George. The Los Angeles Times said recently that our own regular sports commentator, author Stefan Fatsis, might be Plimpton's true heir. Well, here he is with a book review, which is an appreciation, but also a denial.
George Plimpton did it all. He co-founded the literary magazine, The Paris Review. He boxed and pitched and quarterbacked and dribbled with the pros. He wrestled the gun from the hand of the man who had shot his friend Bobby Kennedy in Los Angeles. He interviewed Hemingway in Madrid and Ali in Zaire. He was in Lawrence of Arabia and The Simpsons. He threw legendary parties. He was tall, erudite, and impossibly enthusiastic. In George Being George, a friend of his puts it this way: George saw everything out there as one huge old swimming hole to plunge seriously into and come up with a fish in his mouth. It would have been easy to resent George Plimpton. He grew up a child of old money, New York WASP privilege. He always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. And that voice.
I decided finally to pack the football.
That's Plimpton reading the opening of Paper Lion, his 1966 book about becoming a training camp quarterback with the Detroit Lions, the book that would inspire me, 40 years later, to spend a summer as a place kicker with the Denver Broncos and write my own book.
It was a slightly used Spalding ball, an expensive one, with the information printed on it that it was triple-lined and lock-stitched.
It's hard to imagine how Plimpton got athletes to play along, and to take him seriously, and to like him, which they invariably did. There's a great story in George Being George about the time Plimpton fought the light heavyweight champion Archie Moore. Moore bloodied Plimpton's nose, and afterward, the trumpeter Miles Davis, who was there at Stillman's Gym in New York, inquired, "George, is that black blood, white blood, or red blood?" Plimpton replied perfectly, "That's blue blood." That sort of self-awareness was the heart of Plimpton. As his life unspools in George Being George, you sense that Plimpton understood that he enjoyed advantages unavailable to others, and something about that bothered him. So he chased things that would have been unavailable even to him. He recognized, because of his background and his charm, that he could, and so he did. The writer Calvin Trillin remarks that it took confidence to think of Plimpton's voice as an accent instead of a speech impediment. But Plimpton used it as a tool. It enhanced the self-deprecation inherent in his exploits. There was a flip side, though. Here's the author and editor Thomas Beller reading one of his entries in the book.
Self-deprecation is fine, but in the literary aristocracy that Plimpton embodied, it's a dangerous position. Precisely because it's sort of debonair and easy, he somehow exempted himself from really trying, from what the athletes had had to do to get to where they were, or for that matter, from the dangerous, emotionally daring thing that the writers he ended up publishing in the review did.
As a reader and a copycat, I think that's true. Plimpton was an optimist, a teller of amusing and amazing stories. He once said that, in writing Paper Lion, he wanted to reveal the humor and grace of football. He saw athletes as heroes. He didn't want to visit their dark places. He preferred everything to be marvelous or extraordinary. Was it a weakness? It wouldn't have been his only one. The women in his life attest to that. But it certainly wasn't a disqualifying one. Terry McDonnell, who edited Plimpton for various magazines, comments that, as a writer, Plimpton was half an inch away from Thurber, if he cared. What Plimpton didn't do, write the big novel or the big memoir, become James Thurber or Norman Mailer or Philip Roth, is a fascinating thread in George Being George. Plimpton would remark, jokingly, his widow Sarah says, that he could have been a contender. Instead, he chose a nonstop public life to fit his extrovert personality. But there was an irony in George becoming George. Listen to how the novelist and journalist Jonathan Dee, another former Paris Review staffer, puts it.
The irony is that his whole participatory method was devised as a way to get a better picture of the subject. It wasn't supposed to be about George. But over time, and more or less against his will, his celebrity became such that it overshadowed whatever else he might have wanted you to get out of the story. His persona was his livelihood, and it was also a kind of trap for him.
Intentionally or not, George Being George reinforces that theme. The book gives Plimpton's writing short shrift. Plimpton acknowledged that he didn't invent the participatory genre, but Plimpton made it his own. The way he bonded with the players, his remarkable attention to detail, his thick, anecdotal, rolling prose, his sense of whimsy. I asked Sarah Plimpton what George would have made of a remake like mine.
He by no means felt he cornered the market on participatory sports journalism. He would have encouraged you, and he would have had a lot of fun with it. You know, he was an athlete, too, and he would have been competitive about it, certainly, but I think he would have been very amused to see what you made of it.
I'm flattered to be mentioned favorably in the same sentence as Plimpton, and now I'm flattered by the spirit of Plimpton himself. That was the effect, you learn in George Being George, that he had on everyone. By the end of the book, you just can't believe that someone like George Plimpton existed. Someone so gracious, so curious, so out there, with all the complications that might involve. Here's what Norman Mailer says on the last page of the book. There was something immensely impersonal about George. He wasn't doing it for himself. He was doing it for the spirit of the universe. Or rather, he was doing it for the spirit of the occasion. Because if you improve the spirit of the occasion, maybe that wouldn't be altogether bad for the spirit of the universe. No one will ever be George Plimpton, but it sure feels good once in a while to try.
Stefan Fatsis is the author of A Few Seconds of Panic. It's about playing in the NFL. And Word Freak, about playing competitive Scrabble. And he's also a regular voice on All Things Considered.
The way Americans eat has been influenced by some bold-faced culinary names, James Beard, Alice Waters, Julia Child. But there is one name that until now has been relegated to the pantry of history, Clementine Paddleford. But how could someone with a name like that be forgotten? Here to tell us about her and her contribution to America's cuisine is Kelly Alexander. Alexander won a James Beard Award for Journalism for her feature writing on Paddleford and is the co-author of a new biography of her called Hometown Appetites. She joins us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Leanne.
Can you give us just a short thumbnail sketch of Clementine?
Yes. Clementine Paddleford was most notably the food editor of the New York Herald Tribune and This Week magazine in the 50s and 60s. And as a result of that, she traveled all around the country and indeed around the world in search of great recipes from home cooks.
She was born on a farm in Kansas. What effect did her upbringing on a farm have on her work?
To be honest with you, it would be impossible to overstate how important where she was from was. She grew up with a mother who was everything to her, the kind of woman who worked on the farm, cooked a homemade dinner for her family every night, and really stressed the importance of meals. Growing up in that kind of tradition informed everything about Clementine Paddleford's life, because there was no need to explain to her the majesty of family mealtime. She lived it. She knew where food came from. She knew how it got to the table, and she knew it was the key to a happy family life. So her sort of goal was to kind of take that knowledge that she learned on the farm and spread it around the world, and she did a pretty good job.
How did her writing style differ from others who were writing about food at the time?
Before Clementine, what you mostly had were home economists who put recipes in newspapers on the newspaper pages and very little else. So during a time when you had the kind of breakdown of the oral tradition in recipes, and what I mean by that is, you know, a mother handing a recipe to her daughter and people sharing recipes over their picket fences, that was changing when Clementine started writing about food. And the way it was changing is that newspapers published recipes, but they were largely subsidized. So you would have, for example, the Armour Meat Company in Chicago, who would fund the Chicago's papers' food sections and give you everything but the ham, sometimes even a coupon for the ham. And Clementine kind of breezed along and started infusing the stories behind the recipes. And it changed food writing entirely. All of a sudden, you had somebody who really understood that there was a story behind the woman at the stove.
Clementine was a pioneer, and she went around and visited people, learned what they were eating, learned how they made it. And to get there, she flew her own plane. She had a Piper Cub.
She did. She was a flying enthusiast her whole life. She was very interested in airplanes and aviation, but interestingly, she was a person who had almost no sense of direction, but she kept a map on her lap to kind of refer to while she was flying a plane. I mean, she managed to successfully fly herself around the country a number of times. I'm not sure I would have gotten into a plane with her, but it was a private passion, and she was able to combine it with her work. It made her life more efficient and more fun.
And so she was able to go to some pretty far-flung places that perhaps had food that other parts of the country might not be familiar with.
Oh, definitely. And what I like to stress to people is that she wasn't a parachute artist, as journalists say. She isn't somebody who just sort of plunked down and wrote a story and left. She would do things like go on a 2-week Midwestern tour and spend days in Indianapolis and then days in Cleveland with Jewish bakers learning how to make hamantaschen. She was the first food journalist to visit Hawaii after it became a state. And it seems so different to everything else that was going on in the country. To be able to be the first person to write about taro, for example, people hadn't heard of that, but Clementine was able to introduce them to it.
There are a lot of pictures of her in the book. In all the pictures of her as an adult woman, she's wearing what looks like a choker necklace. But it wasn't jewelry. Explain.
No, it was actually a very clever concealment of a tracheal tube. And as a very young woman in her early 30s, Clementine was diagnosed with throat cancer. And she decided to have a very radical surgery, especially at the time, and have her voice box removed. And for the rest of her life, she conducted all interviews and spoke entirely through the voice box in her throat. So in order to speak, she had to press a button. If you can imagine what that must have been like as a journalist, she interviewed thousands of people doing that. And one of the ways that she disarmed them, because her voice was always very strange and hoarse, is by wearing these kind of outlandish costumes. I often refer to it as her Stevie Nicks outfits. Big, giant swirling skirts and capes, gloves, hats, and always the choker, which was meant to disarm the voice box.
Mm. When she was 62 years old in 1960, she had achieved quite a bit. She was a household name, famous writer. She was rich. She traveled the world. And she thought, what else can I do? And she figured the next thing that she should do was go on a submarine.
Yes. Clementine boarded the USS Skipjack, which was at that time the fastest nuclear submarine in the world. And it was in the harbor in New London, Connecticut. Her whole idea for that started with the idea of a column called What Men Eat on Submarines. So she found out about the Skipjack. She spent several years getting permission and clearances to board it. And she spent the day with the cook, figuring out what they cooked and ate. She wrote about how they stored orange juice crystals, how they made brownies to feed 100 men a day. It was really kind of an exciting assignment.
Yeah. But, you know, she got a little criticism for it. I mean, they called her loopy. They thought it was a publicity stunt.
Yeah. The main detraction on her is that her writing is very florid. It's very over the top. You know, a shrimp isn't a shrimp. It's a pink comma hanging off a glass. And in the Skipjack column, there's almost a breathlessness about it. It's, here I am on this submarine, and it's the most exciting thing in the world. Pinch me. And that kind of quality, that kind of earnestness, you just don't find it very much nowadays. Huh.
So what do you think her lasting effect has been on the way America eats?
Although she is only now beginning to be credited for it, she was the first person who really recognized regional American food as a concept. Before Clementine, there was no clear definition of what American food was. There were immigrants who brought their food traditions here, but they were always considered French food or Spanish food or what have you. Clementine came along and said, you know, Hungarian goulash is as American as Hungarian if it's made in Cleveland, for example. She didn't use the cliche term melting pot, but she was able to say American food is a melting pot of everything that we've come from made with ingredients here. And now she's actually beginning to be recognized for that. Now that you hear the term regional American food all over the place, you can know where it came from.
Kelly Alexander is co-author with Cynthia Harris of the book Hometown Appetites, the story of Clementine Paddleford, the forgotten food writer who chronicled how America ate. Alexander joined us from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stories intended for young readers are often filled with fantasy and magic, but two books released this past year took on very real and sobering subjects, Hurricane Katrina. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this report about two remarkable children's books, Molly the Pony and The Two Bobbies.
Both are true stories about animals that survived Katrina. Molly the Pony, by Pam Castor, is about a small pony that was left alone in a barn for 3 weeks. Later, she learned to walk with a prosthetic leg. More about Molly in a moment. The Two Bobbies was co-written by Mary Nethery of Eureka, California, and Kirby Larson of Seattle. It's a remarkable account of a dog and a cat that rode out the storm together. Nethery and Larson are good friends, both writers, who'd been looking for a story to write together for years. When Katrina hit, they were both transfixed by the news. About 6 months after the storm, Larson went down to Purlington, Mississippi to join cleanup efforts.
What struck me was it was absolutely silent because there were no birds anymore. And you can't convey that with a photograph or even with words. To experience that was stunning.
Around the same time, Mary Nethery saw a segment on CNN about animals that had been rescued after the hurricane. She perked up when she heard someone from the organization Best Friends Society talk about a cat and a dog, both with bobbed tails, that were found together. Their owners had not been identified. Volunteers believe the pets belonged to the same family.
And they managed to survive out on their own in desperate circumstances for 5 months.
Mary Nethery called Kirby Larson to tell her she found their story. This is a passage from the beginning of The Two Bobbies.
Water poured into the city deeper and deeper. People who had stayed through the storm were finally forced to leave their homes. They had to say goodbye to everything they loved. Many were told they could not take their pets. Bobby and Bobcat were left behind. Bobby had been tethered with a length of chain. Bobcat stayed by her side. Together, in the silent heat, they waited for help to come.
Somehow, Bobby Dog broke free. In the research for their book, Larson and Nethery heard that the dog had been spotted roaming through the debris with a short chain dangling from her neck, with Bobcat always close by.
There were email reports. Volunteers had seen this bobtail dog and bobtail cat traveling together, but they were just so skittish that it was difficult to rescue them.
But eventually they were rescued and put in a shelter, but in separate sections, far apart from each other, and they didn't like that at all.
All night long, Bobby howled and barked. Bobcat paced back and forth. No one could sleep with Bobby making such a ruckus.
So the rescue volunteers put them back together. Their noses touched. Reunited at last. Kirby Larson says she and Mary Nethery were careful not to ascribe human emotions to the two animals in their picture book, but they are convinced that the strong bond between them was real, partly because of something they heard from a vet who examined Bobcat.
He found that there were bits of gravel very deep inside his ear canal, and the vet believes that the only way those could have gotten there is that Bobcat must have been in the water at some point. And knowing Bobby Dog, we all believe that she pulled him out of the water.
Bobcat and Bobby Dog were later adopted by a woman in Oregon. The author of Molly the Pony has lived in Louisiana for about 30 years. Pam Castor managed a Red Cross shelter in Baton Rouge during Katrina. Castor is also an equestrian. She's taught riding to children with disabilities and writes for an equine newsletter. A couple of years ago, she was at a fundraiser for the veterinarian school at Louisiana State University.
And they were showing slides of all the different activities that they do. And two of the slides they showed were the surgery of this pony having her leg amputated due to an accident. And I just thought about it, and I decided it would just really make an outstanding children's picture book.
Molly the Pony begins in the early days of Hurricane Katrina.
It rained so hard and so fast that water started coming inside the barn. Molly found a dry place in her stall. All day long, she stood there and waited for someone to take her away from the barn.
3 weeks later, Molly was rescued and then adopted by a woman named Kay Harris, who runs a birthday party pony business. But that's only the beginning of Molly's story. One day, while out in the pasture, she was attacked by a pit bull who bit her on her leg. For a while, Molly managed on three legs. Then Kay Harris took her to veterinarian Dr. Rustin Moore.
And the options were probably only two. One was to either euthanize or humanely destroy Molly, or to do an amputation and fit her with a prosthesis.
Amputation surgery on horses is rare, but after observing Molly for a few days, Dr. Moore decided she was a good candidate because she was small and because she had adapted so well on just three legs.
She was pretty smart. She would get up and lie down frequently. She would switch sides. She was able to do all this not using that affected leg. And so she had a good demeanor about her and seemed to be a fighter.
Pam Castor's book includes photographs of Molly from her rescue from Katrina, her surgery, and from the fitting of her artificial leg. Since this is a children's book, at the bottom of some of the pages are definitions of big words. Pam Castor describes Molly as quiet and demure, but also determined.
Molly sometimes likes to wear her limb, and sometimes she does not. And if she has her limb on and she thinks it's time to have it taken off, she'll go up to Miss Kay and hit her with it. And Miss Kay knows that it's time to take the limb off. Molly and Miss Kay have got a very, very close relationship.
Pam Castor thinks Molly's story is an example of how, 3 years later, those who survived Katrina are rebuilding their lives.
This tragedy has given us all different directions to go in and new ways to start over and to look at life.
Kirby Larson and Mary Nethery hope their book, The Two Bobbies, will give meaning to the tragedy to small children and adults who've never been to the Gulf Coast, so that people don't forget about it.
Unfortunately, we have really short memories. And this is old news now. It happened in 2005, and there is still so much need there.
One final note. Bobcat died earlier this year, just before The Two Bobbies was published. Molly the Pony is now a therapeutic friend to the elderly and children in hospitals. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Brooke Astor spent most of her life, and she lived to 105, putting her name on good works and giving some of the fortune that she had inherited to New York's foremost museums, community projects, and the public library. Her name was a pedigree. In 2006, that name splashed across the headlines of a grim and pathetic story. Her grandson, Philip, went to court to accuse his father, Anthony, of mistreating his grandmother, firing those who took care of her, and skimping so much in her care that she was made to lie down on a sofa soaked with dog urine. And then after Brooke Astor died in 2007, her son Anthony was indicted for stealing from and defrauding his mother. Merrill Gordon covered that story for New York Magazine and has written extensively about the world of the Astors. Her new book is the highly awaited Mrs. Astor Regrets. She joins us from New York. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
First, tell us a bit about Brooke Astor. So many people said that she had this twinkle in her eye.
She really led a remarkable life, and warm, charming, talented. What I found fascinating as I was doing my interviews for the book is that it seemed like every man I talked to, from 30-year-olds to 80-year-olds, gay, straight, married, they would say, oh, Brooke, with this kind of look of enchantment with her. I found that was rather extraordinary.
Well, you use the word. She was a bit of a flirt, wasn't she?
Oh, she learned the art of flirting from her mother. Her father was a Marine Corps general. Her mother was a Southern Belle. She was an only child. And in her autobiography, Footprints, she wrote about her mother's flirtations.
I have to ask, would people have detected that twinkle in her eye if she hadn't been so rich?
I think so, because there was just a genuine warmth to her and talent as a writer, interest in other people. So I think that even before she became the fabulous Mrs. Astor, she had her own world. She had her own friends. She was in her 50s when she married Vincent Astor. So I think she had her own persona well before she became a gazillionaire.
Let me ask you about that marriage to Vincent Astor, who essentially inherited his family fortune when his father, I guess, went down on the Titanic. It's fair to say that the marriage between Vincent Astor and Brooke was not a great love match, isn't it?
It certainly doesn't sound that way, the way she's described it and others have. She was a recent widow. She married three times, and her second husband, who Nancy Reagan described as the love of her life, Buddy Marshall, had died suddenly of a heart attack in November of 1952. And Brooke discovered that she wasn't going to have a whole lot of money. Most of his money was tied up in trusts, went to his children, some to his ex-wife. And she was fixed up with Vincent Astor on Memorial Day, and he proposed literally over the weekend.
What kind of mother was she to Anthony?
She was not a good mother, and that's really one of the sad parts of the story, which I think is one of the reasons that led to this family falling apart. She implied in her autobiography that her son was the product of a marital rape, and she never really bonded with her son. She shipped him off to boarding schools when he was 8 years old. She essentially chose her husbands over her son. Her second husband didn't like the nanny who had brought up Tony. She fired the nanny. And Vincent Astor didn't like Tony, and Brooke shut him out of her life, so that there was a tremendous push-pull. He was always trying to make his mother love him, and I think it was very hard for her. She, as many people told me, she looked at him and she saw his father, and she withdrew.
Anthony Marshall established his own identity away from the Astor fortune, didn't he?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he was a Marine Corps hero in World War II. He then went to the CIA. He set up some businesses. He wanted to become an ambassador, and both he and his mother made major contributions to the Nixon campaign. He was an ambassador in Kenya, a couple of other countries, and then after that term ended, after Jimmy Carter won office, he was out of work, and his mother hired him to manage her money and paid him a salary. She also talked to a lot of her boards and had them put on the board. So there was a sense that he was always Brooke Astor's son. That's how he was known in New York, not as Tony Marshall.
Mm. Brooke Astor passed 100 years of age, and people began to notice a decline. Good friends like Nancy Reagan, Henry Kissinger, and others.
It turned out that she had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2000, and she had trouble finishing sentences sometimes. She would get disoriented. She was slowly losing her grip.
Some staff began to notice that her money was being spent in a way that surprised them, and that's kind of at the heart of this scandal, isn't it?
What was fascinating to me is Brooke Astor led a very public life, but her life was never quite so chronicled as in the last years. Her bookkeeper, Alice Perdue, suddenly found herself being asked by Tony to write checks out of his mother's accounts to theatrical companies. Alice was concerned. She began taking notes and writing down things that just didn't feel quite right to her because they weren't of the interest that Mrs. Astor had had before. And her butler started to hear stories from the nurses about lawyers visiting and things happening. And Chris's reaction was, she's got Alzheimer's and she's signing legal papers and giving away money. This doesn't make sense to me.
And what was the household like?
My impression is she wasn't living in squalor, but certainly the household could have been better maintained. What I think has been fascinating about this case is how it began. Philip Marshall's lawyer originally called it elder abuse. It quickly turned into financial abuse. And the 18-count indictment against Tony Marshall and his lawyer, Francis Morrissey, is really all about money. They're accused of looting her estate and making all sorts of coercing her to make changes in her will. And Annette de la Renta, Philip Marshall, David Rockefeller will all tell you they had no idea this would end in Tony Marshall facing possibly 25 years in prison.
How does a case that began as a concern by a grandson that his grandmother might be neglected and mistreated become a financial fraud case?
The original guardianship lawsuit was settled out of court in October of 2006. Mm-hmm. Tony Marshall agreed to give back all sorts of money, jewelry, books, etc. And people kind of thought that, well, this is over now. Except for during the court proceedings, Brooke Astor's court-appointed lawyer, Susan Robbins, had been looking at all of Brooke's legal papers, and she noticed that Brooke had signed three different codicils, and one of the signatures seemed completely different than the previous ones. She had brought in a handwriting expert. Mm-hmm. So literally within just a few weeks after the case was settled, the handwriting expert announced that he believed that Brooke Astor's name had been forged on a document. So that got the district attorney's attention. They'd already been looking at this case to see what would be interesting, but suddenly they had a forgery charge to investigate.
And what's the status of the case now?
At the moment, they're expected to go on trial sometime in late January, early February.
We should make this plain. Anthony Marshall has pleaded innocent, hasn't he?
Absolutely.
And Anthony Marshall himself is in his 80s.
He's 84 years old, and his defense in all this is that my mother loved me, and my mother realized late in life that she had neglected me, and she wanted me to have these things.
How much was Brooke Astor worth?
Well, the estimate before the market crash was $200 million. I've been curious as to see what she's worth now.
Would this story be quite so fascinating if you took away all the dollar signs?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what struck me at the very beginning, and I kept wondering, how did this happen? I mean, how do you get a son accusing his father of abusing his mother? I mean, and I kept thinking, something must have really gone wrong with this family. And if you dig deep enough, there are many different marriages. It's a little bit about what happens when money becomes a substitute for love. you really find that there are some universal themes that make it, at least for me, made it fairly compelling.
Ms. Gordon, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Meryl Gordon, her new book is Mrs. Astor Regrets, The Hidden Betrayals of a Family Beyond Reproach.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.